Today in Studio 360.
Hello, Caleb.
Do you have a name?
Yes, Ava.
For at least as long as there have been robots in movies, we've been fantasizing about getting intimate with them.
I'm pleased to meet you, Ava.
I'll talk today with director Alex Garland. His excellent new film, Ex Machina, deals with that very question in the very near future. Human lust and even love for robots.
Could you be attracted to a machine that had an aesthetic form that you liked and had a mind? Well, why not?
Plus, the new Broadway show Fun Home turns cartoonist Alison Bechdel's real-life childhood into terrific musical theater. I'll talk with the show's composer, Janine Tesori, and she'll play some songs for us. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show...
Actually, the woman that I've been seeing, Samantha, she's an OS.
You can't resist us, Mr. Powers.
Science fiction writers and filmmakers have loved to speculate about what humans and humanoid machines might do together. That is, what will it be like when they have sex or fall in love? Studio 360's Eric Molinsky wondered why we are so enthralled and tortured by the idea of intimacy with a robot.
A couple of years ago, I got really into this show called Terminator, The Sarah Connor Chronicles. Summer Glau played a killer robot from the future, sent back to protect John Connor. And he's a teenager, so he has confused feelings about his protector.
If I'm damaged, we should know. Reach down under the breastplate. There. What does it feel like?
Cold. That's good, right?
That's good. It's perfect.
Now, back when I was watching the show, I just started dating my wife, Serena. And she wanted to play that game where you make a list of celebrities that you're theoretically allowed to sleep with. She got the idea from a Friends episode. So I figured, okay, I mean, this is just a fantasy. I mean, obviously, I'm not giving her permission to sleep with John Hamm. So, first I put Summer Glau on my list, and then I said, actually, I'd kind of like just to put her character on my list, you know, the hot, sexy Terminator from the future.
That's like, weird. I mean,
she was not amused.
Now that you know that it's about who you find attractive, You now find fictional characters attractive. Meaning, what woman can actually match
so, like, essentially,
these fantasy characters?
I know, it's weird, but it's also a classic trope of science fiction, from the android Maria in Metropolis to Gigolo Joe in Steven Spielberg's AI.
Is this your first time with something like me?
I'm afraid it will hurt.
Patricia, once you've had a lover robot, you'll never want a real man again.
American University professor Despina Kakudaki wrote a book called Anatomy of a Robot. And she says, a robot lover is an appealing fantasy for a lot of reasons. Can be perfectly beautiful, ageless, brilliant, and we're fascinated by its body.
It's indestructible. It has replaceable body parts. It's very compartmentalized, as if it is the alternative to the vulnerable, very fleshy, very gooey, very sometimes smelly human body.
An android can take damage that a human being can't. And some social scientists have actually advocated for the creation of robot prostitutes or robot soldiers. But Kakudaki says when we buy into that fantasy, we're lying to ourselves.
Very often we treat objects with quite a lot of fascination and we treat objects really well. And so there's a way in which when people make these facile descriptions about treating someone like an object, if you think about how we treat objects, yes, okay, we might kick our car if it doesn't start, but we also love them in a way that is really quite invested. And in many ways, it is always cheaper to abuse people.
Very true. But I met a playwright who feels differently.
Honey, what language is it speaking? Like Chinese or some kind of Asian-y kind of?
嬉しいです.
Japanese.
On a Saturday night in Midtown Manhattan, these actors were rehearsing a play by Leah Nonica Winkler. It's about a couple that buys a Japanese robot. The play is called, actually I'll let her pronounce it.
Taisetsu na hito, it means important person. Or I wanted to title it that because that's essentially what the robot is there for the couple.
Her play was part of a Sex with Robots festival.
Mine was the only one that kind of went in a way that was like, we hate this robot and we're very unhappy, so we're going to kill it. A lot of the pieces were like, my wife died, so I'm going to create a robot, or I'm horny, so I'm going to get this robot sex. Yeah.
Winkler thinks this is all a healthy fantasy about not feeling shame or being judged in a relationship because your partner is not a person.
You can do all the things that you're embarrassed about communicating to an actual human partner on this robot. I mean, you know, like I like seeing guys, humans, but like if there was a sexual companion guy, I would not be above buying one if I was lonely.
Of course, we are very, very far away from ever building a robot that could actually pass for a human. So what we're left with are human actors pretending to be robots. And that's what I find fascinating. Here's Despina Kakudaki.
My favorite example for that is someone like Commander Data in Star Trek.
Data, you are fully functional, aren't you?
Of course, but...
How fully?
In every way, of course. I am programmed in multiple techniques.
You have this character who is really quite beloved by audiences, who is emotionally not able to feel the certain kinds of emotion or certain kinds of pain. So you can say that that shows a type of lack, or what a pity he's unable to feel that emotion. But the fact that we keep putting him in situations where he might feel that emotion, but actually, happily, he doesn't, it implies a type of investment in not having to feel that emotion ourselves.
Even if some of these robots have programming that allows them to have feelings, they still have this emotional shell that's so much tougher than ours. Because they're not real. And we humans should be proud to be made of softer stuff. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
A longer version of this story first appeared on Eric's podcast, Imaginary Worlds. You can find out more at studio360.org. And by now, I'm certain Eric has rushed out to see the new movie, Ex Machina, which is an extremely unnerving, extremely intelligent thriller that uses the sexy robot archetype to really push the question of how real artificially intelligent creatures can be. The lifelike robot in this movie has been invented by this super-rich alpha male tech genius. He invites a shy young programmer who works for him to his fabulous lair to test whether she or it has achieved true consciousness.
Hello.
Hi. I'm Caleb.
Hello, Caleb.
Do you have a name?
Yes. Ava.
I'm pleased to meet you, Ava.
I'm pleased to meet you, too.
Ex Machina is the first movie Alex Garland directed. He wrote the novel The Beach, as well as the screenplay for the seminal modern zombie movie 28 Days Later. And he is here with me now. Alex Garland, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
So there is, as we've heard, a long line of attractive female robots in cinema going back to Metropolis in 1927. When you got the idea for this film, were you thinking, okay, we've got to make Ava distinct and different and not too reminiscent of any of these others, or male robots for that matter in movies?
Yes, definitely, in as much as that the first time we see her as an audience member, I didn't want audiences to then be thinking about another movie at that moment. You want the audience to be locked in and responding to Ava as Ava. And there is a thing that happens within film. It's very easy to be self-aware and to reference other films.
Oh, it's like 3PO's sister.
Exactly, yeah. And in fact, you mentioned C-3PO, one of the design things we discovered was even a little bit of gold in her design immediately made you think of C-3PO. A metallic torso made you think of Metropolis, and white plastic made you think of iRobot and so on. Huh. So the first part of the design was actually ruling things out rather than defining what she actually looked like.
Huh. So hypothetically speaking, and you must have thought through this since a lot of this film is about, so do you want to have sex with her, kid? Would you hypothetically have sex with a robot?
I would say I have no problem with that question, in truth. I would say hypothetically, yes. The reason I would say yes is that the thing that we value in each other, I think, is our minds. That's actually where human rights and everything we care about stems from the existence of our consciousness and our minds. And if a machine has a mind in the way that we believe we have them, everything then flows from that. And could you be attracted to a machine that had an aesthetic form that you liked and had a mind? Well, why not?
At one point, the Nathan character explains why he gave Ava sexuality, and I want to play a clip of that scene.
Sure.
Did you program her to like me or not?
I programmed her to be heterosexual, just like you were programmed to be heterosexual.
Nobody programmed me to be straight.
You decided to be straight? Please, of course you were programmed. By nature or nurture or both. And to be honest, Caleb, you're starting to annoy me now because this is your insecurity talking. This is not your intellect.
That's Oscar Isaac and Donal Gleason in the film Ex Machina. In the movie, Donal Gleason plays this nerdy programmer, Caleb, who apparently falls in love with Ava. Is he is attracted to what? To the person,
to the package,
yeah,
I would
say.
The
whole package.
Yeah, to the package, exactly. That is to say, if the machine Ava had the physical attributes that is presented in the film, but spoke in the way that Siri in your mobile phone speaks, I don't think the attraction would happen.
Yeah, I'm never attracted to Siri.
Well, quite.
You never in the film, I think, call her a robot. She's always referred to as an AI, artificial intelligence. Why?
It's really... in intention, it's a film about consciousness, which may or may not be housed within a machine. And so to, I guess it's about keeping it on point, maybe.
Well, and so much of the AI in movies that we've seen have not been embodied. I mean, HAL most prominently was not. And then a couple of years ago, maybe more to the point, in the Spike Jonze movie Her, she was not.
Yeah, I haven't seen Her.
Really?
No,
Did you avoid it?
I avoided it, yeah.
I'll bet.
I think... 2001, it's very interesting question about embodiment because there's a very strong argument that says that consciousness needs to be embodied in order to...
That's a serious philosophical scientific argument.
Yeah, very much so. But you could also say HAL is embodied in the physical structure of the ship and with this beautiful, strange eye lens that we keep returning to and we visually associate with him.
Yeah. Caleb is ostensibly brought there to subject Ava to a kind of modern version of the Turing test. Can she convince a human being that she is conscious and human? One of the pieces of dialogue in the movie is about this that the Caleb uses is, oh, it's like a chess computer. How can you know if the computer knows it's playing chess, which chess computers don't?
Indeed.
Is that – and of course – I find this question of will machines ever be sentient fascinating because how do we know? They're not just in some machine-like way doing the ultimate simulation. I mean, do you have a are you agnostic on that subject or do you think they'll get there?
I tend to lean always more towards atheism than agnosticism, I would say. My atheism in this particular instance would be about what consciousness actually is and whether we perceive it ourselves correctly.
Oh, that we're just machines who think we're conscious.
Well, I think we are machines, yes. Essentially, yeah. and I think we do think we're conscious.
Yeah.
But I do think we probably slightly dignify what consciousness is, yeah. over dignify, maybe slightly deify.
Yeah.
So look, here's this thing you set up. Can you tell whether this machine has a consciousness and what is it thinking? You ask a question that feels like a natural question to ask of this machine. It turns out you can actually ask that question of each other. A lot of your sense of my consciousness is actually an act of faith.
Yes.
You believe you have a consciousness and
yes.
you then decide I probably do too,
yes.
because of the, I'm like you and because of the way I behave.
Yeah, yeah.
But to actually prove it or demonstrate it is pretty tricky. And then you can actually ask that question of yourself. And suddenly the whole thing gets a bit uncertain.
So I take it that you are not on the side of those nervous people, especially in England, where they have all these institutes for how AI is going to destroy the world.
Yeah. Centers for Existential Risk.
Exactly, yeah. At Cambridge and Oxford. So you're not on that side of the feeling. You think, oh, this is going to happen and we'll make – and they'll be our descendants in the universe.
It's complicated. I mean, I'm ambivalent, I suppose. I think that – typically, when something is possible, we do it. And in that respect, if AIs are going to be possible, then the argument is not should we or shouldn't we, but how are we going to deal with it when it does happen? If what we're talking about ultimately is the creation of a consciousness,
yeah.
To me, again, that relates to parenthood. We routinely create new consciousness.
This is what the machines want you to think and want you to be saying. They've convinced you. You're just their propagandist.
But it's also what I want.
Yeah.
They might be at some point all of us that survive, and we need to get on board with that and decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I see it as, in a way, something evolutionary.
Right.
They're not. We can choose to see an AI, a strong AI, as being distinct from us, or we can see it as a product of us. That's why I keep coming back to this child thing. The limit, like the very least we want of our children is that they have at least lives that are as good as ours, and that they outlive us. And I sort of attach those kinds of thoughts towards these machines.
Well, you put that argument, which is one of the arguments of the AI singularity people, much better than they do, so congratulations. Alex Garland, this has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Ex Machina is out right now, and I talked with Alex Garland for the better part of an hour. And if you want to hear us geek out even more about robots and the singularity, you can listen to that full conversation at studio360.org. Still ahead, hundreds of dogs stage an uprising against the humans who abuse them in a new film. And the dogs, not computer-generated, real ones, give amazingly convincing performances.
You might think it's just a badass dog, a junkyard dog, or a dog that's mean, and these guys aren't at all.
They're acting.
Yes, they're acting, absolutely.
We'll hear from the trainer responsible for the star dog. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
I missed you, Peter, and I love you.
I have never cried in a movie theater like I cried 20 years ago watching that final scene in Homeward Bound. I like my sweet sentimental dog movies. But the new Hungarian film, White God, is an altogether different cinematic breed. The sheer number of dogs in the film is just staggering, 250 of them. And a lot of the time, the director keeps his camera low at canine level. The film is about a girl forced by her father to give up her beloved pet, Hagen. Abandoned and on the loose, he becomes a ferocious fighter and ends up leading a band of feral dogs who rise up against the humans who mistreat them. One reason I'm more of a cat person is the training part. I don't have the patience or time to teach an animal to sit or anything else. So how on earth do you get 250 dogs to do anything at once and one to give a performance central to a movie? We sent KCRW's Matt Holtzman to spend some time with the star of White God and his trainer to find out.
It's a long road from total obscurity to a packed screening at the Sundance Film Festival.
This is Bodhi.
Bodhi and his twin brother Luke were discovered by animal trainer Teresa Miller.
Their collars on? Okay.
I met Teresa and another trainer named April Morley in a beautiful park in the outskirts of L.A.
He says, "I know you."
Hi, baby.
Who's that, Lukey?
Oh, my God, Lukey.
You don't have to love dogs to love these dogs. They're knee-high, they're black and tan, and they have curly tails and crinkly faces.
Yeah, they're really unique in their appearance, you know, and side by side you can really see the difference, you know, but it's less obvious on film having, you know, just seeing one at a time.
They have incredibly expressive faces.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
What are they, really?
They're actually Shar-Pei lab mixes.
I must say, they're a lot smaller than I thought they'd be after seeing them in the movie.
But what's funny is that's what they say about actors.
It puts 10 pounds on you whether you like it or not.
Teresa was given a tough challenge by writer and director Cornel Mundruszko. Like any director, he had very specific ideas about his lead actor.
He wanted the naivety of the dog, a new character who hadn't acted on screen, and really to treat it more like a documentary.
Mundruszko wanted a dog that would look lost and alone wandering the streets of Budapest. And an experienced animal just wasn't going to pull that off. The problem was Teresa only had a couple of months to find two of these one-in-a-million dogs because animals, like people, have different kinds of personalities suitable for different kinds of scenes. You also need multiple animals because they can get tired and distracted during shoots and you can swap one for the other. So with time running out, Teresa frantically searched the web. And finally, she thought she found a pair of dogs that just might work. She got in her car and headed to Arizona and prayed.
I'm just like, God, please make this work, you know?
She found the 10-month-old puppies in a small mobile home living with a family and three other dogs. She watched them play with the other dogs and especially with the kids.
To see them interact with the children, that was a huge selling point because they needed to work with this little girl. And I called the director immediately, showed him a videotape, and he says, do you think they can do it?
She said, absolutely. But then she got home from Arizona.
And I put the leash on him, and it was like a rodeo. I mean, bucking, bronking, screaming, never been on a leash before. Just so he wouldn't hurt himself on the driveway, I move over to the grass so he can relax on the leash and get to know it. They'd never seen grass before. They jumped up, didn't know what the hell the grass was. And that was a scary time for us because I didn't know what we'd gotten into because my director thinks we're going to do a movie with these dogs.
Teresa had just 16 weeks before these two dogs were supposed to fly to Budapest and star in a major motion picture. And so they went to work.
Bodhi. He's standing right now on his mark, which today happens to be like an 8-inch square piece of wood. And the reason we use that is because sometimes he has to be in frame. Hey, watch. He's good. Sometimes he has to be in frame and... I can't have a trainer starting him or releasing him because it's in the frame of camera, and so we'll use his mark.
In Teresa's hand is a very realistic-looking rubber chocolate chip macadamia nut cookie.
We've got our actress sitting at the picnic table in the park. A little strange that the dog would bring her a cookie in his mouth, but just an example for you. I wouldn't take the cookie, but for this particular scene, it's okay. So he's got the cookie. Take it. Hold it. Go with her. Go with her. Stay. Hold it. You can take it, April. Good. Speak at her. Speak. Good.
Don't forget that not only did these dogs have to be trained for their roles, they had to be trained to work with 250 other dogs. Over in Budapest, the man in charge of those dogs was Hungarian trainer Arpad Halish. While Teresa was working with Luke and Bodhi, he and his army of trainers were rounding up a huge group of strays from local shelters and trying to turn them into movie extras.
I never imagined we could put 250 dogs together to run through the streets of Budapest, and it was Arpad who said that he could do it.
Did you tell him that you didn't believe it could be done?
Absolutely. I didn't hide it from anybody.
For his part, Arpad wasn't so sure that Teresa could train her dogs to do what director Cornel Mundruszko was expecting. Hagen starts off as a little girl's pet, then wanders the streets in fear, and then he turns vicious. And in the end, he's the leader of a pack of wild dogs. If you've seen the movie, it's really hard to imagine these sweet dogs playing tough.
Well, hi, Bouncy. You're such a silly. Hey, what are you talking about? It's interesting because as silly as Luke is, and he really is the nut, you can just tell in his mannerisms, he is the best one at looking aggressive. He is the one that shows all his teeth and raises his lip, and his brother gives more of a low-key growl and serious look without showing his teeth.
Finally, after months of figuring out which dog would play what scene and training them to do it, Teresa, Bodhi, and Luke were ready to fly to Budapest and mix it up with 250 strays in White God.
We had so much to do with the Hungarian team of trainers. And we'd never met, and we had a language barrier. And I knew how much we had to accomplish together, And, of course, it's going through my mind, how accepting are they going to be? Because here's these American trainers coming over to do their job. And that's where the concern came in. And they were amazing.
After a couple of weeks of working with the pack, they began to shoot. And everything went great, even the scenes where sweet little Hagen turns mean.
You might think it's just a badass dog, a junkyard dog, or a dog that's mean. And these guys aren't at all.
They're acting.
Yes, they're acting, absolutely.
But can dogs really act? Well, at times when Hagen looks at Lily in the movie, you'd really think so. And there's definitely a difference between that kind of interaction and the tricks Hungarian trainer Arpad Halas taught some of his dogs.
I mean, he taught some beautiful things. I mean, when you see his dogs in the tunnel and you see them getting shot and that dog rolls and stops, he taught his dog to do that. I've never seen that taught before.
As for Bodhi and Luke, no doubt they turn their wet noses up at such simple theatrics. And because of their acting range, Teresa Miller is expecting big things from them.
It's been 2 years now, and they've gotten one other job, and it was for a rapper named Waka Flocka. And, of course, my dogs played abandoned dogs in a mobile home park, and which is ironic.
Clearly, after directors see them in White God, they're going to be able to pick and choose their next roles. For Studio 360, I'm Matt Holzman.
White God is in theaters now. A couple of years ago, for one of our extra credit challenges, we asked you to make music using birdsong. We're still interested in this idea, which made us suckers for the work of Ben Mirren. He is a suburban Boston birdwatcher turned New York City beatboxer who decided to combine his two passions.
I started to incorporate birds into my beatbox routines because, as a mimic, I was able to imitate certain bird calls. The American bittern, the gadwall, which is like a, the common eider, which is a wonderful duck that makes a very human-like sound. It goes, and as I started to share my love of birds with beatboxers, they just ate it up. They loved it. I had a debut performance at the American Beatbox Festival in 2014 where I improvised an entire set of walking around the forest as a bird guide. Like, I'm walking through the forest to look for some birds. Birds, birds. There's one. There's two. It was totally off the cuff and people went nuts. Right now, I am making a video of me performing on my loop stations and pattern sequencers. I sift through thousands of different tracks that I have on my computer of each bird recording. A lot of them come from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and I've listened to enough of them to find some that are actually in a single key. So I heard two notes, and so I started to build those together. And then had a beat in mind. Until I start to hear a composition assembling in my head. The epiphany was when I came to the trumpeter's swans, I started to hear this new melodic line that would go over the entire beat, and it just brought it to life. It was bum 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 ba bum bum. All those notes are bird sounds. When you're a beatboxer, you can walk around and just create music on the fly. And my craft is about using beatbox to build a bridge to the natural world.
That is Ben Mirren. Daniel Gross produced our story. Coming up, For the first time in history, the main character of a Broadway musical is an out lesbian.
What happened last night? Are you really here? Joan, 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 Joan.
That musical is Fun Home, and its composer, Janine Tesori, plays for us next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
I'm changing my major to Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan.
This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. No woman ever has composed more Broadway scores than Janine Tesori. And she didn't even write her first musical until she was in her 30s. After switching college majors from pre-med to music in the early 80s, she spent a decade arranging and conducting musical theater until she pulled herself out of the pit and holed up in a lighthouse to create a musical of her own. She has just written her fifth Broadway score, the new musical Fun Home. It tells the real-life story of the cartoonist Alison Bechdel, who grew up in the family-run funeral home, and as soon as she leaves home, discovers all sorts of secrets. The composer and co-creator of Fun Home, Janine Tesori, joins me now to talk and play. Janine, welcome to Studio 360.
I'm very happy to be here.
Good. And congratulations on Fun Home. It is not only a pleasure and great work by all concerned, but I am predicting it's going to be your longest running show ever.
I would enjoy that a lot. Well, I would really enjoy it.
You owe me a dime if it happens.
I will, with interest.
Okay. Speaking of long durations, turning a graphic memoir into a musical was, I understand, a long, tough piece of work.
Musicals are always, the gestation of a musical is always long.
I know.
But this one was particularly long because the source material itself is dense and not a narrative that's linear. So we had to understand it in a way of how it would transform, not just transfer, into a musical form.
And it actually took you 3 years to write the opening number?
It took us, the interesting thing is it took us years, almost the entire time of 5 years, to understand that there wasn't an opening number. Of how to come into the book is almost, was it should feel as effortless as opening a book.
Rather than the big traditional Broadway opening number.
Exactly. That thing that you come out and, you know, and a tap number. I still want to put a tap number in there, but it's just, it would feel shoehorned, I think. But I was surprised by the ease with which the musical had to open. That first 3 minutes, the pact with the audience had to be made a new way that I hadn't done before.
Will you play something since you're sitting at the piano from
Fun
Home? What will this be?
This is going to be Changing My Major. I just a caveat that I'm a writer who sings-ish, so I will do my best. What happened last night? Are you really here? Joan, 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 Joan. Hi, Joan, don't wake up, Joan. Oh, my God, last night. Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, last night. I got so excited, I was too enthusiastic. Thank you for not laughing. Well, you laughed a little bit at one point when I was touching you and said I might lose consciousness, which you said was adorable, and I just have to trust that you don't think I'm an idiot or some kind of an animal. I never lost control due to overwhelming lust, but I must say that I'm changing my major to Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan, with a minor in kissing Joan. Foreign study to Joan's inner thighs, a seminar on Joan's ass in her Levi's, and Joan's crazy brown eyes. Joan,
I feel like Hercules. Oh, God, that sounds ridiculous. Just keep on sleeping through this and I'll work on coming down. So by the time you've woken up, I'll be cool, I'll be collected, and I'll have found some dignity. But who needs dignity? 'Cause this is so much better. I'm radiating happiness. Will you stay here with me for the rest of the semester? We won't eat any food. We'll live on sex alone. Sex with Joan. I am writing a thesis on Joan. It's a cutting-edge field and my mind is blown. I will gladly stay up every night to hone my compulsory skills with Joan. I will study my way down her spine, familiarize myself with her well-made outline while she researches mine. I don't know who I am. I've become someone new. Nothing I just did is anything I would do. Overnight everything changed, I am not prepared. I'm dizzy, I'm nauseous, I'm shaky. I'm scared. Am I falling into nothingness or flying into something so sublime? I don't know, but I'm just before I was lying prone in this dorm room bed with Joan. Look, she drooled on the pillow, so sweet, all sweaty and tangled up in my bedsheet, and my heart feels complete. Let's never leave this room. How about we stay here till finals? I'll go to school forever. I'll take out a dementedly huge high interest loan. 'Cause I'm changing my major to Joan.
That is Janine Tesori playing and more than singing-ish. I'm changing my major to Joan from her new musical, Fun Home. That song is sung by the character Allison when she's in college. She's just found out she's a lesbian and she's just had sex with a woman for the first time. Was the idea of that song always, we have to make this funny so that this majority straight audience will find it completely charming?
I think the idea of this song was a subset of how I felt and how Lisa felt.
Lisa Krohn being the book writer and lyricist.
And heightened by the sense that what Lisa told me, as a gay woman, that she wasn't afforded in adolescence, that she didn't have that time walking down the hall with a girlfriend or pen and inking notes or hearts into her notebooks. And so what happened was an unbelievably goofy and really hysterical combination of a first time of love and romance and sex that has been building and building to this moment, which was, you know, ripe for comedy.
It sounds, having read about your involvement with this show and other shows, that you are much more than the composer. For instance, I read that in the scene right before the song comes in, that it was you who insisted that the girls needed to kiss.
Yes. Yes, that's true. I think that what Lisa, we all, my mentor early on when I started as a conductor said, you must conduct everything as if you wrote it. Huh. And so now I feel like I'm writing everything as if I've conducted it and designed it and have to act in it. Because I think the more that you go from the empathy of what the people, not just viewing it, but the people who are inside it, underneath it, behind it, for every moment of this ephemeral moment on stage, there are 100 people behind it. And I think it just really behooves you to do that. So I wanted to school myself as much in dramaturgy as I'm not a composer who can just get a lyric and set it. I mean, I can, yeah. But it's not as interesting to me as to be part of that cohesive team.
back to this particular question, though, why was that even an issue, whether they should kiss?
You know, Lisa's incredibly brave. She has been doing things in theater in downtown for years, and she said, you'll see, you'll see. They can't kiss, you'll see. And I didn't understand what that meant, and what she meant was that they would be laughed at, not the audience wouldn't be laughing with them, that they would be laughing at them. And she didn't realize, and I think it's to her great joy, that that's just not the case at all.
Musically, in this show, you obviously embrace the pop music that this Allison character, the real Allison, would have grown up listening to in the 1970s, and presumably you did. Can you maybe play some notions of what I'm talking about from the show? Like, for instance, when she and her siblings hilariously dance around to advertise their mock advertisement for the funeral?
Well, that seems to come out of we decided to make a commercial, that they were going to make a commercial, because they didn't realize that a funeral home is not and it's like anything else that a family does. It's the family business. So we did a
to give him the best. Whoa, come to the fun home. That's the Bechdel funeral home, baby.
It's like
so,
that.
And we're hearing a little bit, Jackson 5.
Yes, it's exactly, because that's what they've been listening to. They wouldn't be making up their
right.
own tune.
And it is the moment in the show, I think, maybe where you completely get the audience to love you and everybody on stage.
Well, the thing about those kids and the joy and the innocence of them, and I talked to a lot of families who had, they had grown up in the funeral home business, and everyone to a T said, they got so used to dead bodies. They got so used to caskets. They, you know, it didn't even, to the point where for a lot of them, it was really troubling when they would go to funerals later in life.
And they had to like take it really solemnly?
Yeah, and take it solemnly. And they weren't signifiers that caskets mean solemnity or sadness. It had been something that sometimes one family said whirled right through their kitchen table. While they were eating dinner, they would move their plates and the body would go through. And then they would resume eating. And I thought, oh, God.
You have also talked, I've read, about the importance of risking and expecting and admitting failure. And when you talk about that, do you mean creative artistic failure or box office and reviews, that kind of failure?
Well, I've had both. It's so much easier when it goes
time?
Your way. Yeah, absolutely. Huh. And sometimes, you know, I think that it's not just developing. People always say, oh, you have to have such a tough skin. It's like, no, you have to have – perhaps you have to have a tough skin, but the pores have to remain open. The very thing, as you know, as a writer, the thing that makes you vulnerable and interested and curious, and I would use the word humble, is or the beginner's, what the Buddhists would call the beginner's mind, to me, is what I never want to lose. I never expect anything to go well. As a Sicilian, I never expect that. I'm just so amazed when things go well. And so I think they're so tricky and they're so dependent on so many things aligning. And when that happens, it's just fantastic. However, I think I feel that for girls that I've observed, and later with women, that failure is linked to shame. I've just failed and I've been declared talent free in some paper. And
is that a quote from a review?
Someone did declare me devoid of talent, but you know.
Well, you've proven them wrong many times. You, among other things, have a great range. I want to take a listen to a few things quickly. Here's Thoroughly Modern Millie, which is so 1920s sounding. And Carol Interchange, which is variously bluesy and Motowny.
Salty tears in the ocean.
And as we heard you do earlier, Fun Home is, among other things, so 70s. And I could go on. You did Shrek the Musical, which was very different again. Do you think of yourself as having a style?
I go show to show. And so I think my style is linked to the dramatic event, is what I would say. I was taught by a wonderful pianist, and part of the reason why it would, I guess people have called my career eclectic, is that he presented me with music from all over. I played TV themes and Stravinsky, Kavaleski, Beethoven, and Born Free from the Mr. Big Note collection. And he never presented it in any way. And we did improvs and lead sheets. And he never, it was never accompanied with judgment. He just said, be curious about everything and anything that your ear goes to, listen to it. And later my mentor would say the same thing. And so I think I attach myself to worlds that I want to musicalize. And it, for me, hopefully not in a party trick kind of way, there's always an aspect about the period that interests me.
Whether it's the 1920s or 70s or whatever. And the trick, of course, is to be eclectic and to not be a hack.
Yeah, right. It's a fine line between eclectic and hack.
Yes. Yes. I was shocked to read how many songs you write for a given show that don't ever get used.
Yeah, I wish I could get there quickly, but it's just not. I guess that's my other style, is it's a very it's sort of like the Twilight Zone anxiety spiral. But I find it really difficult to get the entire score on the first sweep. There are temples that hold a score up. I could link to it. Ring of Keys is the first complete song that we wrote, and I knew that was right.
In Fun Home,
and then Changing My Major. There's certain things you think, okay, it's solid. I understand it. Uh-huh. I understand. To me, theater songs are often like dogs with backpacks. They have a little job to do. They carry something from one place to another.
That's a cute metaphor.
And I've got so many dog metaphors. Got a million. And that's when I know, okay, that's right. This thing is just, it's got too much cabaret. It's too subtle. There's something we just haven't gotten it. It doesn't have that sturdy, it will play to a house of 700 people. It doesn't have it.
Are there any songs from Fun Home that you wrote that you remember that didn't make the cut?
Oh, my God. We wrote, Lisa Crohn would kill me, I don't know if I remember it. We wrote a song called Antigone in Vermont when we were desperately trying to make that work when she would just come in and it was 4:30 in the morning. I remember she would sing like 4:30 in the morning, and there was a whole
this
thing
is
about
the adult
this.
Allison.
Adult Allison. There was a point where she went a life in boxes. It went like, you know, it was just not it. But we were getting closer. I think it's sort of like a fox hunt technique that I use, and that's why it takes so long.
Another dog metaphor.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I don't know. I've just ordered a new puppy, and that's probably why I'm there.
When you are sitting at the piano, as you are now, to start something, how does that actually work at the very beginning of a piece or of a song in a thing you're doing?
What I try to do now is not work at the piano. If I'm at the piano, it's to, you know, remind myself how Hawaii 5-0 used to go. And
da-da-da-da-da.
I mean, I really wowed them in second grade when I played that. I try to write away from the piano as much as possible. I also write at a dry erase board, and I draw what a song is supposed to look like, or how it fits into a show, how the sequence of events goes. I'm trying not to use the piano as anything except what the orchestra is going to do, because it's a much wider range than the orchestra, and not write for the piano.
So you've already written the song by the time you get to the piano.
I've tried. There are intricacies of the accompaniment that I haven't worked out, but I've thought about. I write a lot when I'm walking or when I'm thinking about something else. I remember Einstein's quote about brushing your teeth and coming up with ideas. I think that's when the mind gets really released to be creative.
Janine, it has been a pleasure talking to you today.
Likewise.
Fun Home is on Broadway right now, and at studio360.org, you can hear all of the songs that Janine Tesori played for us today and see a video of her playing one of them and hear the entire conversation that we had, which is much longer than we were able to play for you right now on the show. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening today. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
Jenny Lawton,
David Krasnow,
Martha Little,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frassica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoek.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, not even halfway through 2015, and the biggest names in hip-hop have all released great new music. Kanye West, Drake, and Kendrick Lamar. Is hip-hop having its best year ever? That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.